From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. Well, we continue with Rochester and the Finger Lakes' favorite books, 2024. It's a great chance to hear about some of the books that our guests have loved and maybe books that we have not heard about yet but might want to read in 2025. What stood out about these books? What made them so popular here? So we are here for this wonderful annual tradition. And it has become a tradition just about every year, I think every year since I started hosting this program 11 years ago. These 2 hours, you are hearing about fiction and poetry and nonfiction and YA books and even a horror novel. There's all kinds. And let's continue now on Connections. Our first guest this hour comes from right down the hall, one of the voracious readers and really smart people I know, the music director of Classical 91.5, Mona Segetola-Slami. Welcome back.
Good to see you, Evan.
I mean, I've seen you. I see you every day. I don't know why I'm saying welcome back. You work here, too.
Yeah, not here to talk about sports today, though.
Oh, see, that's for another day. This time, you got to choose anything you wanted to from what you read in 2024. And this is a very interesting-looking book. What did you choose?
The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay by Michael Chabon. It's been out for 24 years, so I'm not maybe bringing you something very new, but it's new to me this year, and I couldn't put it down.
Well, Michael Chabon has, for many years, been a very highly regarded writer, but why did this come to you this year? How did this land on your lap this year?
So my husband bought it a few years ago when we were in New York City and went to one of our favorite bookstores there, and it's been sort of sitting around the house, and I picked it up and started reading, and it was a slow start, but once I got past the first chapters or sort of into them, I just, again, the storytelling, the sweep of it, the quality of the writing absolutely just drew me in. So
he is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for this book?
I think for this book, actually.
I think for this book, literally 24 years ago in the pre-9/11 days. So you want to set the stage a little bit? I know you're going to do a little reading in a second, but describe a little bit about what this book's about.
Sure. So it covers a bit of the beginnings of the comic book industry and Jewish immigrants in New York City. I mean, it's a fictionalized version, but it really, I think, ties into a lot of real things, and it connects to a lot of trends across 20th century American history in that way. If you like the sort of way that history goes when you're reading A Devil in the White City, even though that's nonfiction, I feel this does the fictional version. Another book I read recently that does this over history in Korea and Japan is Pachinko. So that kind of sense of a saga over decades, but also a personal story of individual people.
You want to read a passage here?
Sure. So I love reading out loud, which has probably worked out for my job. And this, I was always looking for someone to read something out loud to from it because I loved it so much. So every universe, our own included, begins in conversation. Every golem in the history of the world, from Rabbi Hanina's delectable goat to the river clay Frankenstein of Rabbi Judah Lev Ben Belazel, was summoned into existence through language, through murmuring, recital, and Kabbalistic chit-chat, was literally talked into life. So I guess that probably resonates for us, but it's in the same chapter that actually starts with, in the immemorial style of young men under pressure, they decided to lie down for a while and waste time. They took their shoes off, rolled up their shirt sleeves, and loosened their neckties. They moved ashtrays around, swept stacks of magazines to the floor, put a record on, and generally acted as if they owned the place. So I don't know. I love the turns of phrases. I love the sense of creativity. There is all this wonderful story, very specific to coming from the Czech Republic, from Prague, and interacting with Houdini. Actually, they meet a lot of famous people in this book. I don't know if that's a spoiler. Like, there's these sort of almost punchlines of bumping into famous personages of American history, but also they're some of the first superhero comic drawers, and then they're also involved with radio and novelty companies and the whole sweep of this, and Coney Island and New York City in the old days and so much. So,
the prose that you just shared seems to have a really deft combination of something sort of grand and sweeping and also very direct and comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Not easy to pull off.
Yeah, I think it's maybe perhaps also appeals to my love of the low and highbrow, right? It is a grand statement
about
all in one sentence. Yeah, right. You know, time immemorial and wasting time, and The idea of what is it to be making something, to creating something, but also like this scene of this sort of roughshod guys with their ashtrays and their records and everything.
This Chabon novel is not short. If you're going to commit to it, how many pages there, Mona Sagatolson?
Let's see how many pages. And then I have another...
Roughly how much here?
Over 800, not quite 900.
800 pages.
Wait, so that, over 600. I don't have, I apparently need readers. Okay, 670
so not something. So bad, 600 some. Are you someone who can start a book and then quit it if it's just not ringing your bell like 30, 40 pages in?
Mostly, I think so. I'm a very fast reader, but sometimes not an attentive reader. I get really caught into a story. And so if someone asks me about details later, sometimes I get lost.
No, that's interesting. I'm a slow reader for pleasure.
Mm.
I'm a fast reader for work. And these days, most of the books I read are for the show. Although I have the advantage of saying, if I really want to read a book, I just try to get the author on because
nice.
Now I have to read it. And I think one of the, I'm going to get clumsy here, but I've been wanting to like figure out how to say this. There are times where I feel like if I am reading for pleasure, I am not being productive enough with my day.
Mm.
Like I have a to-do list of things I have to do. And how do I have time just to sit and read for pleasure? I've got a book of George Saunders essays that I'm halfway through that I want to finish. And every time I pick, and essays are an even shorter way of reading. I have 20 pages. I could do that. But I feel like, no, I should be getting this project done or doing something else or getting ahead with work. Do you struggle at all with that? Or do you find yourself, it's easy to read?
I've always been a reader when I should have been practicing viola when I was younger. I used to sneak books and said I was doing stretches so I wouldn't get tendonitis. So, you know, I was slacking off by reading, and I love reading science fiction and fantasy ever since I was younger. And so, in a way, like, this touches on that with the comic book world, but it isn't at all. So it's funny that it's become my favorite book. The thing I can say to yourself, if you need help with justification, is of course being a well-rounded, fascinating person full of ideas running around your head is part of your job. So it's very important for you to read something you shouldn't for your work, unless that ruins it and you just want it to be an indulgence. But you can make it part of becoming who you are.
Yeah,
but that's not why I read.
No, right. No, I think that's intensified as I've gotten older, and I don't like the way that feels. Because I never really feel so good as when I am coursing through a gripping book, a book that I feel like I just have to stay up until I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to read so much for work that over the years, it's like I just have such a stack of work reading. If I've got six books I know I have to read in the next month or two,
that's
huge. can I justify reading a book that's not on that list? And I often feel like I can't.
I am perhaps that way about listening to music. I love listening to music. It's what got me into doing what I do. But I also sometimes when I'm home, think, can we just sit around in the quiet for a bit? Which is actually why I don't really often do podcasts. The reading isn't, it's loud with ideas in my head, but it's not listening. It's not listening to work. Radio is work, even though it's what I love. So.
Well, you said you're a fast reader.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a slow reader because I'll reread a paragraph or soak it and really try to digest it, especially when it's for pleasure. One thing that I'm really struggling also with, this is all about my struggle sessions. I'm dumping it all on you, Mona.
It's fine. We're working it out here on air in front of our audience.
Working it out. I think that's Mike Birbiglia's podcast, Working It Out. But no, younger people, now I'm generalizing, but literally teenagers, 20-somethings, they will listen to podcasts on double speed so they can listen to more. They will listen to books, but they'll listen on 1.5 or 2 speed. I cannot do that.
My husband does that, especially if he's watching YouTube
videos. Your husband
videos.
Does that.
Yeah, and we're about the same age, in the early 40s. And
my brain can't do it. Like, my brain needs time to process.
And it does. But I also get impatient with podcasts or someone reading to me. So maybe, I don't know. But I read quickly, as I said. It's sometimes because I get caught in the story, even though I should. This book had me loving the language, which made me go back a few times. Because something that made me sometimes slow down reading is reading graphic novels and comics. Because if I'm just racing through the story and the dialogue, mm-hmm. I'm missing a lot of it. So I should be luxuriating in the beauty on the page and the complication and all that's there. So that's one that, surprisingly, reading comics and graphic novels makes me slow down because I like eating slower. I really have to think about it.
Well, then while we're working it out, one more thing here. While I got you.
Yeah.
I've actually been rereading Calvin and Hobbes. And I read it like I'm reading philosophy. I love Bill Watterson's mind. And my son got me the complete collections because he knows I love them, and I was kind of bringing them to him when he was younger. But I'm going back and rereading now, and a lot of the stuff that really gets me is really existential stuff. But it's comic books. It counts, right?
Yeah. It absolutely, well,
comic strips is what it is.
If you're enjoying it, if it's making you think, if it's engaging you, why not? And of course, sometimes it's engaging and sometimes escapism, but it doesn't need to have a long narrative to mean something. I mean, you've got poems, you have haiku, you have, right?
Well, how much do I owe you for this session? It's been really lovely.
It's been really lovely. Can I add one more fact about, actually, it all ties in, because
something I read
for fun has now become related to my work. Composer Mason Bates, who is a contemporary orchestral composer who also incorporates electronica, wrote the opera The Revolution of Steve Jobs. His latest opera just premiered in workshop at my alma mater, Indiana University, and it's coming to the Met, I believe, next year or in a year or two, is an opera version of the Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. I don't know how 670-something pages of story is going to fit within an opera, because when you adapt a book into a movie or an opera, I feel sometimes people try and stuff in too many details. But there's an opera version of this that we'll be able to see in the next year or two.
Wow. Awesome.
So it all comes back to, and I guess, you know, the world of classical music for me, even though this was something I read completely outside of work.
We still got it back there. Happy New Year, Mona Segetola-Slamy.
Happy New Year, Evan Dawson Knox.
Thank you very much. It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2024, and our next guest is someone that listeners probably heard on this program many times over the years. He was a journalist with the Democrat and Chronicle, an author, and now he's a research and communications coordinator for Our Local History. Justin Murphy, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Evan.
So you picked two. Your assignment was one, and you failed the assignment.
No, I didn't. I just changed it.
You changed the assignment?
So I picked these two because they go together. And some of my favorite books and things to learn about are things that make me look at my own environment in a different way. And I also, this kind of harkens back to before my career in journalism and what I'm doing now, I had sort of a brief career in linguistics. And so these are both language books that change the way that you can look at what's around you. The first one, it came out this year, is by Ross Perlin, and he's the co-director of the Endangered Language Alliance in New York City, and it's called Language City. And the premise of the book is that of all these thousands of endangered languages in the world, you know, linguists will often go out to these exotic places to study them. And he's based in Queens, and he says that, in fact, New York City is the home of more endangered languages than anywhere else in the history of the world, because people from all over the world have gone there to speak them. And so he takes you on a tour of places in New York City where, unbeknownst to anybody else who's walking around, there are like the last dozen speakers of this language from India that you've never heard of before. And it's like, you know, to you or me, it's completely opaque. We would have no idea that that's going on. But he talks about the work that his organization has done to record them, to support people in various kinds of revitalization efforts. And, you know, that makes me think, like, that's true here in Rochester too, of course. That's true anywhere you go. Sometimes it's easy to overlook stuff. You would have no way of knowing that the person speaking a language that you don't understand is actually, it's unique in some way, just like all of our language is unique in some way. The other book, it's older, but I read it this year. It's by a guy named Aaron Lansky, who's the president of the Yiddish Book Center, and it's called Outwitting History. And his story is, he, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, kind of got interested in Yiddish literature and thought that he would take it upon himself to collect the outstanding books that there were published in Yiddish. Thought that there would be like maybe a couple thousand of them, and ended up with like, I don't know, more than a million or something.
Wow.
And that's been his whole thing. And so this story, it's kind of like an adventure story about him going into all these old Jewish people's houses and seeing what they had in the attic. And there's a lot of it about like feelings about Yiddish versus Hebrew and kind of what is worth preserving and what is not. And it's similar to the other book in that it gets at this, like, we have these kind of standards around what's important to us, what counts, what we pay attention to, and what kind of just goes unnoticed. And they both dig into that in a really interesting way.
I think this is really, when did you get into linguistics? When were you in linguistics?
Well, so I got a degree in linguistics from the University of Chicago, and I taught linguistics the year after I graduated from college. But that the time in between, that summer right after I graduated, was like a really formative year for me. And I've talked about this in a lot of different circumstances, but I had a professor who studied a Native American language called Washoe. It's around Lake Tahoe. And there's at that time, there's probably fewer than 20 native speakers left. And so I went out with him for the summer for research, and our job was to create a dictionary. They didn't really have one. It was an online dictionary. And so we would spend all day across the table with these native speakers just eliciting phrases. How do you say, I'm going to cross the street? I used to cross the street. I want to cross the street. And we'd cut it apart. We'd parse what the different things were, the different parts of speech, and then we'd put it online for them. But, you know, to tie it back to these books, something that I really took from that and that I took in my career in journalism is that you can't just, like, ask for this information and receive it. It needs to be a deeply personal connection. You need to know the people. You need to, you know, kind of, like, get dirty as you're looking for information. And that's very much what these authors did, is they spent a huge amount of time becoming trusted and understanding the people that they were working with.
So you, a deep thinker, you travel and you study with tribes, with endangered languages. Me, not so deep a thinker, I listen to pop songs. And I was thinking the other day, as I listened to an almost 20-year-old song by a band called Stereophonic called Have a Nice Day. They're Scottish. There's a line in the song that for some reason stuck with me that is coming to my mind now, about how the homogenization of culture around the world has dulled us. And the line is, you know, we've all become the same. We're all going wrong. We've all become the same. We dress the same way and only our accents change. And I'm thinking of the point of that is to say that there is something actually beautiful in the difference in culture, but also language. I mean, there's a lot of talk about how we should homogenize language, about how everyone should speak the same, or wherever you live, you should only speak one language. What do you think the value is of preservation, you know, beyond just the academic pursuit of it?
Well, I mean, preservation is one thing, and it's a fact that languages have been dying off and will continue to die off. They have throughout history, and that's accelerating with the rise of global English and things like that. But, you know, languages, as we all know, are so much more than just the message that we get across. That encodes so much about our culture, our family, ourselves. You know, even for us as kind of basic speakers of Northeast American English, which is not, you know, unique or special in any kind of way, we've all got things that we say or turns of phrase or things that we picked up from maybe family who had a different language history. We've got ways that we cross over and speak with people who speak in a kind of a different way. And, you know, that to me is one of those things that, especially if you don't have contact with people that speak other languages, and it's easy not to, it's easy to overlook the ways that can enrich all of our experiences in so many different ways.
The name of the two books again for listeners?
The first one was Language City by Ross Perlin. That came out this year. And the second one was Outwitting History by Aaron Lansky.
And we'll have all of these books collected in our show notes. By the way, Justin Murphy, the book that you wrote is now how many years old?
That was published in 2022. Boy, I considered making it my pick for the third year.
You've been reading your own book.
That felt a little gauche.
Will you tell the listeners what it's called?
My book is called Your Children Are Very Greatly in Danger.
And it is one of the really important works of local history. You working on anything else?
I'm always working on something.
You want to break any news?
No.
Okay.
I'm not a journalist anymore, so I don't break news.
Don't break news. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in.
You too. My pleasure.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2024, and our next guest is one of our colleagues here, one of the volunteers for Connections at WXXI, and someone who has retired from working on the River Campus Library System at the University of Rochester. Someone who's been around books, I don't know, forever. Mari Tsuchiya is with us. Hey.
Hey, thank you.
Nice to see
thank
you here.
Thank you for having me.
I mean, I see you all the time, but it's
yeah,
nice
right,
to see
exactly.
How often are you, how many books are you reading a year?
So this year is a year of anxiety, so I escape to the books. So I read and listen to 40 books.
40 books.
Yeah, so like every 2 weeks I read one.
Really, more than almost a book a week.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Are you reading or listening?
So about half of them I listen to it. And one thing I found out was Spotify give you 18 hours of free books.
Yeah.
So I can listen to one book for free, and then I get some listening privilege from New York Public Library. So that's how I did it.
And what did you choose for one book of the year? What was it?
So I would say it's really this. I actually have two, but then one will be Butter by Yasuko Yuzuki.
Butter.
Butter.
Okay.
So it's actually a murder, thriller, mystery, and then based on a true story about two women. One is a serial killer. She is a gourmet cook.
And a gourmet cook serial killer. Yeah, that's good.
And the the other protagonist is a journalist, female journalist. And then this is how she's cracking on the case.
What makes the book great?
One thing is it's not gruesome, but it's more like a human story. There are lots of interesting characters, mm-hmm. and they are all intriguing and somewhat likable, even the serial killer. So it's a page-turner. It was one of the bestsellers in 2020 in Japan. So it was finally published and translated here in the United States this year.
So that book is called Butter, and you chose a second?
Second one is Mina's Matchbox by Yoko Ogawa. She's one of my favorite authors. And this was translated this year and first published in 2006 in Japan. And this is a story about interesting family in Japan 1970s during economic growth. And also the characters are all very likable. And that was kind of one of the books I really liked it because it was not stressful.
but also a work of fiction, yes?
Yes.
So both of what you chose have roots in real life, but they are works of fiction.
Yes.
Are you mostly reading fiction?
I did. I did some nonfiction reading, but I thought that fiction was more easy to escape to because I knew it was fiction. I want to
sometimes
from...
you need that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. So
Butter, the first book. The name of the second book.
Mina's Matchbox.
Mina's Matchbox. And how would you say, so the first one was a page-turner. How does this one compare as a page-turner?
The second one is kind of nostalgic because it's my childhood in Japan. Mm. So it's a story about Olympics in Munich and a story about, some... food and some daily life that it's brought me back to my childhood. So that's why I liked it.
It was a year of anxiety, you said.
Yes, year of anxiety.
Are you going into 2025 any less anxious?
Hopefully. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
We're all hoping, I guess.
Yes.
Well, thank you. You do such lovely work with us on this program.
Oh, thank you so much. I love walking here. It's a great place. Yes.
Wonderful to have you. Happy New Year, Mari.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Got to take our only break of the hour. More of Rochester and the Finger Lakes Favorite Books 2024 coming up. I'm Evan Dawson. Happy New Year. On Wednesday, some special national programming from NPR. And in the second hour, NPR programming on the death of former President Jimmy Carter. President Carter passing away this week at the age of 100. Reflections on his career and life Wednesday. Our next guest is the president and chairman of the board of the Monroe County Bar Association. Sarir Fazli is back with us, and it's great to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
It is a pleasure and an honor to be back here, Evan.
Oh, an honor, I don't know, Sameer, but it's great to have you, and it's nice to talk about books. We're talking to a lot of Rochesterians and Finger Lakers and Western New Yorkers about books that really stood out to them this year. Could be a new release, could be a book that they returned to. What's the book that you chose, Sameer?
I chose Colonizing Kashmir. Colonizing Kashmir is a very painful tale of a very long effort and project by the Indian government to literally colonize Kashmir and cement its occupation over the last almost 70 years, but it deals with a very particular period in the time of when it started.
So you and I have spoken about Kashmir on the program in the past. I know it is not always on the radar of Americans who don't have roots there. So is this a book that will help people who are not familiar with the conflict start to understand it?
Not necessarily. This book, it gives obviously a very brief history of the conflict and how it started and its roots. Unfortunately for Kashmiris and students of the region, what this book does is it goes into the real details of how the occupation and how the colonization really took hold and the incentives that were offered and taken advantage of, the lack of any accountability and checks and balances, either from a governmental or a judicial standpoint, contributed, and essentially how corruption at all levels solidified the occupation in Kashmir at a time when the flavor and the feeling was for freedom.
Today, as we head into 2025, are you feeling optimism or despair about what's happening there?
You never say never. It is very difficult. It's a difficult thing to discuss. Kashmiris are under more and more occupation from a governmental level, from a judicial level, and even from a social level. There has been an influx of outsiders that have taken hold and very high positions within the government and even administrative offices, whether it's banks or other or medical institutions or otherwise. There's not much infrastructure there that is run by Kashmiris themselves anymore. So that creep has continued, and more the voices that advocate for freedom, that advocate for some honesty and integrity, those are more and more silenced. There are more people that have either died or been killed or jailed, especially since August of 2019, that have really been cowed. It has cowed the population into silence.
I think it was H.L. Mencken who once said that people deserve the right to vote. And when they do vote, they should get what they voted for. Sometimes they'll get it good and hard. A lot of people are talking about that in the context of the recent American election. My read on you is that you really do believe in the right of self-determination among populations around the world, not just in one place or another, that you think it's very important that people do have the right to choose their government, their leaders. It is not always going to be choices that people like or go well, but hopefully through enabled freedom that people have the chance to correct or change those. So when you look at Kashmir, do you see a path to that kind of self-determination? Or do you feel that one of the problems is that there is no self-determination?
Well, the unfortunate thing is that there is no self-determination. On August 5th of 2019, the Indian Parliament essentially removed the one safeguard that kept Kashmir relatively separate from total Indian dominion, and that was its Article 370 of its constitution, which allowed Kashmiris a special status. That was removed, and essentially that was an attempt to integrate even more Kashmir into India. And it was done by the BJP government, the current government still running India. Just this year, there were so-called elections in Kashmir, which is now it's not considered a state. It's considered, there's a word for it, a union territory.
Union territory.
So there was an election there. A bunch of people who have historically been yes men and women to the government of India. And the voting was such, when Kashmiris came out to vote, their vote was seen as a protest against the BJP, more than in favor of the people that they were voting for. The people that they were voting for appeared to them as their, you know, people that had always been in the chairs, albeit not necessarily doing what the people elected them to do. But now those same people were somehow being seen as a savior, as a last bastion against even more creep by the BJP. So that is being seen by many political analysts as the Kashmiris' continued voice of protest against the Indian government.
As we close this brief interview here with Sarir Fazali, I want you to once again mention the title of the book and the author, and then understanding that everyone has limited time, limited options. Well, people can choose to listen to Connections. People can choose to listen to podcasts, choose a book. If they're going to choose to devote some time to this book, Colonizing Kashmir, they're going to do it because why in 2025, Sarir?
Colonizing Kashmir was written by Dr. Hafsa Kanjwal. Full disclosure, she's my niece. She is a PhD from University of Michigan, and she is an assistant professor of South Asian history at Lafayette College. The amount of scholarly research that she has done on this book, there are over, if memory serves, 300 to 400 footnotes on all of her sources. I have not read, albeit it is very near and dear to me, the topic, I have not read a book that was this detailedly researched for there to be a true narration of a very difficult time in the history of Kashmir. If people are interested and really want to learn and get into the nitty-gritty, this is the authority, you know, that, you know, Stanford University Press published this book. And at least for somebody like me, I found it to be one of the most educational, albeit painful, books that I've ever read.
Sarir Fazali is the president and chairman of the board of the Monroe County Bar Association. Happy New Year. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you and yours.
It's Rochester and the Finger Lakes Favorite Books 2024, a tradition we've been doing just about every year for the past decade. We close the year with some great book recommendations from a wide variety of people. And my next guest is another one of my WXXI colleagues. Mona Isler is back with us.
Hello.
Hello. You didn't choose just one?
No, it's a two-part book series, so I have to talk about both of them.
Again, people have found creative ways to ignore the rules of the assignment, but you're somebody who's very good at finding creative ways to ignore the rules, I think.
I was born to ignore rules.
So what did you choose?
So I chose a book series called Nubia. The first book is called Nubia, The Awakening. The second book is called Nubia, The Reckoning. And these books are by esteemed actor Omar Epps and his writing partner Clarence A. Haynes.
Omar Epps?
Omar Epps wrote books.
I just feel bad I didn't know that.
I didn't either.
When did you find out?
I came across them on TikTok as a recommendation from somebody else. And I went, Omar Epps, like the Omar Epps? And I did a little bit of digging, and it is true. He has written some YA fantasy, and they are phenomenal.
YA, young adult, is who it's aimed for.
I feel like I'm a young adult deep down.
You're a young adult at heart?
Yeah.
The books are good.
They're phenomenal. They're really, really good.
Okay. Why so?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background about the books. So the books are set in 2098, New York City, and New York City at this time has suffered a lot of cataclysmic climate change.
Yeah.
And the story is set on these set of refugees called Nubians. They were from a destroyed country somewhere in Africa called Nubia. And they are refugees to the United States and are treated the way refugees are often treated, relegated to the poorer parts of town, into the areas where the climate change has affected the city the most. And it is focused primarily on three teenagers who discover that they have powers. And they were taken aback by that. Their parents, who were the ones who came across, had lost all of their powers, they discovered, and the teenagers started to gain powers, and it was about how they reckoned with dealing with those powers and then how they used them for ill and for good.
The rich in this society live in a city called the Up High.
The Up High.
Tell me about the Up High.
So the Up High, there was a land developer who has figured out how to further separate the haves and the have-nots by building a safe city, literally up high above New York City, above Central Park, where you have to take elevators miles into the air. And people are aspiring to move to the up high to get away from the dangers of climate change down below. And so it is a book a lot about class, about trying to aim high, working hard, doing your best. One of the main characters, his whole aspiration before he discovered his powers was to be the best at everything he could be so that he could be accepted into the up high for college or whatever, and to become whatever it is, to leave all of this behind. So there's a lot of class, but there's also a lot of racism, you know.
Well, the implication with the up high is that the wealthy and powerful would hoard resources.
Can you imagine? It's wacky. I don't even know where they get these ideas from for these books. But yeah, it's a little bit dystopian in that way. But it is also quite accurate to a description about the way that we operate in this country.
So I was reading recently a set of comments that were made in, I think, 1950 by a couple of writers who were predicting the future. And of course, World War II had ended, the nuclear weapons had been used. And their prediction was that in anywhere from 2 to 10 years, the world would be wiped out by nuclear war. And they really believed it. They thought at the very least, before the end of the 20th century, the world would be fundamentally changed because of either nuclear war or societal total breakdown. And despite a lot of problems that continue, that hasn't happened. We haven't seen more nuclear war. I bring this up because this book that you chose, is the series, is set in 2098. That's before the end of this century.
Correct.
And I think having children is an act of optimism or hope. I know you love your family. I know you love you got the cutest grandson in the world.
In the world.
Do you ever look far ahead and think about the world he's going to be an adult in? And when you do you find yourself more optimistic or more pessimistic?
Oh, boy. Depends on the day of the week, right? I think we always are thinking about the world that we leave behind for our kids and our grandkids. And I feel like I'm currently in such a jaded place. I'm in a very cynical place politically and socially right now.
More than normal.
And so I really am focusing very much just on my inner circle. I am not thinking outside of my own, up of the world, outside of the world that I have. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And I think because that's what keeps me having hope, is focusing on the moments that I get to spend with my grandson and watching him grow up. But also knowing that as doomsday as we tend to be when things are really bad, that the world is a really ultimately a good place, that there are good things that are always happening. Good people are doing good things. People are looking out for their neighbors. They are, you know, making great medical discoveries and all of those things. So I keep that sort of in the back of my head as I become a little bit insular right now. Does that make any kind of sense?
Well, yeah, for sure. And I think, look, I believed in the act of having children and thinking about the future in an optimistic way. I feel a lot of fear, because a lot of what you described, this way of becoming more insular and kind of huddling up with your family and friends, is a really powerful thing. But at the same time, especially the kids in my family, they're going to be here longer than I will. And forces that are far outside of that circle that I've got no control over will affect them.
Absolutely.
And that's what I wrestle with the most, is how do you create a world where those forces don't just become some sort of really negative thing? Now, human beings are very innovative. We're capable mm-hmm. of getting to the end of the century and well beyond in decent shape, but we got to choose it. And we haven't always made good choices.
Well, I think that's the thing. I think the reason why we keep waking up every day is because we believe, no matter what, that people are going to make the right choices. The problem is that somebody else's right choices aren't necessarily my right choices. Mm-hmm. So the only thing we can do is to instill as much hope and value and joy of life and optimism in these kids, because they are the ones who are going to have to make different choices. We've already messed it up. It's too late now. I mean, I'm talking about my generation. And so we have to make sure that my children and my children's children understand what it means to look out for your fellow man, what it means to, you know, have a societal view that is about helping those who are less than us, who have less than us, who are more marginalized than we are. And eventually, the hope is that there are enough of them to actually make the changes that will undo the dystopian future that sits inside my brain.
Well, for a view of that future, you can pick up Nubia. It's a two-part series. The first book is The Awakening. Omar Epps, and Clarence Haynes.
It's phenomenal. And our book club read it, and Clarence Haynes came to our discussion, and it was fantastic.
Happy New Year. Thanks
Happy
for coming
New Year
in.
To you. Thanks for having me.
Rochester's Favorite Books 2024, one of our great annual traditions here. It's really Rochester, Finger Lakes, all of Western New York. We invite a number of people on, avid readers, to share their favorites or most memorable or standouts from this year. And my next guest, he wrote a book that would have been on my list for Book of the Year. K.E. Semmel's book is The Book of Losman. I have to say as well, I would not be surprised if this book gets translated everywhere, if it gets picked up somewhere. We kind of talked a little bit about how this is the kind of book that could become a movie. And that's, I don't even like saying that, because I remember an Onion headline. One time, one of my favorite Onion headlines was, "New Harry Potter movie awakens children to the magic of not reading." Do you like that?
I love it.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I just say that because, you know, it doesn't need to be a movie to be great. The book is great. I hope the book's doing well. It's such a pleasure.
It seems to be. And, I've gotten so many positive feedback from readers. It's been a joy, actually.
Well, congratulations. 2024 is a great year for K.E. Semmel, because the book's out now and anyone can get it. But we asked you to choose a book that you read that stood out. You're a translator as well. And I want you to take us through the title, the author, and why you chose this book.
So the title is When Death Takes Something From You, Give It Back, by the Danish author Naomi Ait. It is translated, wonderfully translated, by Denise Newman. This was a National Book Award long-listed book from 2019. And, it's the backstory for me in this is I translated Naya's previous book called Rock, Paper, Scissors, and I translated it for Open Letter Press based right here in Rochester. And while we were working on edits, I had sent an email to Naya, basically with some questions, as I do with most of the authors that I work with, and saying, like, what do you intend for this particular passage? Like, what were you meaning here? Or these kinds of questions. And then, of course, I went to bed. It's 6 hours ahead in time there in Copenhagen. And in the morning, I got a one-sentence response from Naya via email that had nothing, of course, to do with any of my questions. In the email, she simply said in Danish that her son had died in the night previously. And the way, and even saying this now, it still brings chills to my spine. Naya is such a wonderful person, truly one of my favorite Danish writers, and just someone that, over the years we've communicated so often. And I never met her son, but the fact was, and what she wrote in the email essentially was, he had jumped out of a 6th floor apartment building and died. But he had taken some mushrooms, and he had had a bad experience on the mushrooms and died. And so that really put a damper for quite a few weeks and possibly months. It's been about 10 years now since this email and since this translation. And I remember thinking, you know, how awful that would be. Now, my son at the time was about 6. And, you know, when you have a child, you know, the feeling of just the absolute joy and love that that child brings in your life. And to imagine, you know, nobody wants to imagine something like this happening to their child. And about 3 years later, Naya published this book, When Death Takes Something From You, Give It Back, in Danish. And I remember when it came out, and I couldn't read it. I was simply too, I guess, emotional about doing it. I just didn't want to read the book. I couldn't read the book. Couldn't bring myself to read it. My wife tried reading it, and she couldn't read it. It's very difficult stuff. And so this year I finally sat down and I read Denise Newman's translation of the book, and it was extremely powerful, and as I expected it would be. And it was truly the best reading experience of my year, in large measure because it deals with a subject, losing a child and grief, in such a way that it really, it's a really moving reading experience. And to have a moving reading experience is truly one of the most pleasurable things about reading at all.
Do you want to read a passage?
Yeah, I'll read a little passage.
Why don't you grab it? I'm going to hold the microphone here.
So first I want to say that the book is it's a collection of poems, letters, journal entries, and various things. And in this way, it's kind of fragmentary and kind of illustrative, I think, of the experience of grief, particularly in when it's as raw as it is in right after the fact. And so this is a section where she is recalling something shortly after his death. I'm sitting on the floor surrounded by your handwriting and in a bag containing all the letters you've received over your lifetime. I find 15 photos. They're the pictures you took at 9 years old when we were in Norway together and visited, among other things, that tiny island whose name I've forgotten. I'm sitting on the floor and it's 10 days after I wrote about our trip. The first 14 photos have no people in them. There is the sea, cliffs, green grass, small red wooden houses, boats, and a harbor with shacks and a little ferry and white lamb-like clouds in the light blue sky. I begin to cry. Why am I crying? I put the photos away. For several days, I can't figure out why those particular photos made me cry. Then I realize it's the absence of people that made me cry, as if the people had disappeared, as if all human life had been sucked out of the scenes. One morning, I take out the photos again. I find the 15th photo. It's of you, 9 years old, on the airplane, full of life, on the way to Norway with me. Your front teeth are new and jagged. You're looking straight into the camera. So the entire book, it's as you can see, it's about 150 pages. It's not a long book.
No.
But it is the kind of book that you know, will take some time to read because it is very much about the experience of grief and a mother's grief.
This year, I had a brief chance to meet a musician who I've liked for a long time, really loved his work for a long time. Of all things, it's the Canadian band Bare Naked Ladies.
Huh.
But when I met Ed Robertson, I knew I only had a couple of seconds, and I just wanted to tell him that he's written a song that I think is one of the most profound things I've ever heard, and it's called God Forbid, and it's about the idea and the fear of losing a child. And it's about the way that human fear evolves throughout a lifetime, and if we are fortunate enough to become parents, we acquire new fears that we did not know we could feel.
Yeah.
And that fear never really leaves you. But what Naya has gone through is the ultimate loss. I mean, that's probably why that email hit you so hard, because you feel for her, you feel the empathy. There's nothing you can do. Then you think about yourself, you think about your son. It's it's the worst. And what a powerful subject for a book.
Absolutely. And it's by far my favorite book of the year for 2024.
It's called When Death Takes Something From You, Give It Back. Naya Marie Aidt, A-I-D-T. Where do people get this, Kyle? Well, K-E Semmel?
You can get it wherever books are sold. That's my usual refrain. I want to add that it's translated by Denise Newman, a wonderful translator as well in her own right. And Naya is a poet as well as a fiction writer. So she writes with a poet sensibility and just quite a wonderful ability with language.
I'll close with this. I've over the years just loved talking literature with K.E. Semmel, who is now an author, and I'm just curious to know if there will be a second K.E. Semmel book in 2025 or 6.
There won't be. I haven't even started writing anything recently other than small essays and things like that that I've been doing. I have manuscripts sitting, but I have to revise them.
Might there be another eventually?
Eventually, yeah. But, you know, the process of publishing a book is lengthy,
yeah,
as you know.
Yeah.
So don't expect anything in 2025, but hopefully soon.
My favorite essayist, the late David Rakoff, had a way of describing the process of writing that is so graphic I can't repeat it here. But suffice to say, it is difficult, it is often painful, and you often don't get a lot out of the product. So, but it's always, I hope, worth it. Your book's beautiful. Thanks for sharing with us this with us. And K.E. Semmel, Happy New Year. We'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
And that does it for Favorite Books 2024. We really enjoyed these conversations. I hope you have too. Once again, we've got a full list of the books chosen by our guests in the show notes coming your way for Connections, wherever your podcasts are sold or offered. And that way you can check out what you have missed and make plans to add to your reading list for 2025. From the entire team at Connections, Happy New Year. We're so glad you choose to spend some of your days with us. And we can't wait to start the next conversation in 2025. Thanks for joining us here on member-supported public media.